Meeting Benedict Arnold again, I was glad for his courtesy in offering me a ride. The air was thick with moisture, and the sky white as a muslin sheet. My shift was moist with perspiration after only a brief walk. I would have been wringing wet, and likely on the verge of heatstroke, by the time I'd walked as far as King Sessing. The General was excited, both by his new appointment and by the impending military developments. He was not at liberty to tell me what those were, he said, but Washington was on the move. Still, I could see that his excitement was much tempered by regret. He was a natural warrior, and sitting behind a desk, no matter how important and ornate, was no substitute for the bone-deep thrill of leading men into a desperate fight. Watching him shift in his seat, hands clenching and unclenching on his thighs as he talked, I felt my uneasiness deepen. Not just about him, but about Jamie. They were quite different kinds of men, but Jamie's blood roused at the scent of battle too. I could only hope he wasn't going to be anywhere in the vicinity of whatever battle might be impending. The General set me down at the ferry. King Sessing was on the other side of the Schuylkill. He got out himself to hand me down from the carriage in spite of his bad leg, and pressed my hand in parting. "Shall I send the carriage to retrieve you, Mrs. Fraser?" he asked, glancing up at the hazy white sky. "The sky looks untrustworthy."
"Oh, no," I assured him. "I shouldn't be much longer than an hour or two about my business. It won't rain before 4 o'clock. It never does at this time of year. Or so my son assures me."
"Your son? Do I know your son?"
His brow wrinkled. He prided himself on his memory, Jamie had said. "I don't think you would. Fergus Fraser, he's called. He's my husband's adopted son, really. He and his wife own the print shop on Market Street."
"Indeed."
His face lighted with interest, and he smiled.
"A newspaper called The Onion? I heard it mentioned in The Ordinary, where I breakfasted this morning. A patriot periodical, I gather, and somewhat given to satire."
"L'Onion," I agreed, laughing. "Fergus is a Frenchman, and his wife has a sense of humour. They do print other things, though.
And they sell books, of course." "I shall call upon them," Arnold declared. "I'm quite without books, having left such belongings as I possess to follow after me. But really, my dear, how will you get back to Philadelphia?"
"I'm sure I can borrow some form of transportation from the Bartrams," I assured him. "I've been to their gardens several times. They know me." In fact, I intended to walk. I was in no hurry to return to the Chestnut Street house, and my cantankerous prisoner. What the devil was I going to do with him? Particularly now that the British had left. And it was no more than an hour on foot, but knew better than to tell him that. And we parted with mutual expressions of esteem. It was only a quarter hour's walk from the ferry to Bartram's garden, but I took my time about it, as much because my mind was still on General Arnold as because of the heat. When? I wondered uneasily. When would it begin to happen? Not yet, I was almost sure of that. What was it? What would it be that turned this gallant, honourable man from patriot to traitor? Who would he talk to? What would plant the deadly seed? "Lord," I thought, in a moment of sudden, horrified prayer, "please, don't let it be something I said to him." The very idea made me shudder, in spite of the oppressive heat. The more I saw of how things worked, the less I knew. Roger worried a lot about it. I knew. The why of it. Why were a few people able to do this? What effect, conscious or unconscious, did travellers have? And what ought they to do about it if they, we, did? Knowing what would happen to Charles Stuart in the Rising hadn't stopped him. And it hadn't stopped our being dragged into the tragedy either. But it had, maybe, saved the lives of a number of men whom Jamie had led from Culloden before the battle. It had saved Frank's life, or so I thought. Would I have told Jamie, though, if I'd known what the cost would be to him and me? And if I hadn't told him, would we have been dragged into it anyway? Well, there weren't any bloody answers. no more than there had been the hundreds of other times I'd asked those bloody questions. And I heaved a sigh of relief as the gate to Bartram's garden came in sight. An hour in the midst of acres of cool greenery was just what I needed.
Chapter 23, in which Mrs. Fig takes a hand.
Jamie's breath came short, and he found that he was clenching and unclenching his fists as he turned into Chestnut Street. Not as a means of controlling his temper, he had it well leashed and it would stay that way, but only to let out more of the energy inside him. He was trembling with it, with the need to see her, touch her, have her tight against him. Nothing else mattered. There'd be words, there needed to be words, but those could wait. Everything could wait. He'd left Rachel and Ian at the corner of Market and Second to go on to the print shop to find Jenny, and he spared an instant's quick prayer that his sister and the wee Quaker might get on well together, but this vanished like smoke. There was a burning just under his ribs that spread through his chest and throbbed in his restless fingers. The city smelled like burning too. Smoke hung under a lowering sky. He noted automatically the signs of looting and violence. A half-burnt wall. The smudge of soot like a giant thumbprint on the plaster. Broken windows. A woman's cap snagged on a bush and left to hang limp in the heavy air. And the streets around him were full of people, but not those going about their business. Mostly men, many of them armed, half of them walking warily, glancing about, the rest standing in loose knots of excited conversation. He didn't care what was happening, providing only that it wasn't happening to Claire. There it was, number 17, the neat brick three-story house that he'd rushed into and out of 3 days ago. The sight of it hit him in the pit of the stomach. He'd been in there perhaps 5 minutes, and recalled every second. Claire's hair, half brushed and clouding up around his face as he bent to her, smelling of bergamot, vanilla, and her own green scent. Her warmth and solidness in his arms. His hands. He'd grabbed her by the arse, her lovely round arse, so warm and firm under the thin shift, and his palms tingled with the memory of instant lust. And no more than an instant later. He pushed the vision of William out of his mind. William could wait too. His knock on the door was answered by the rotund black woman he'd seen on his first arrival, and he greeted her in much the same way, though with not quite the same words.
"A good day to you, madam. I've come for my wife."
He stepped inside, past her open mouth and raised brows, and paused, blinking at the damage.
"What happened?" he demanded, rounding on the housekeeper. "Is she all right?"
"I expect she is, if you're meaning Lady John," the woman said, with a heavy emphasis on the name. "As to all this..." She rotated smoothly on her axis, gesturing toward the gouged, blood-smeared wall, the broken banister, and the iron skeleton of a chandelier lying drunkenly in a corner of the foyer. That would be Captain Lord Ellesmere, Lord John's son. She narrowed her eyes and glared at Jamie in a way that made it apparent to him that she knew damned well what had happened in the hallway above when he'd come face to face with William, and she was not at all pleased. He hadn't time to worry about her feelings, and pushed past her as politely as possible, heading up the stairs as quickly as his twitching back muscles would allow. As he reached the top of the stair, he heard a woman's voice, but not Claire's. To his astonishment, it was his sister's voice, and he approached the farthest bedroom to see her back blocking the doorway. And over her shoulder... He'd felt unreal ever since his conversation with William at the roadside. Now he was convinced that he was hallucinating, because what he thought he saw was the Duke of Pardlow, face contorted in annoyance, rising from a chair, clad in nothing but a nightshirt. "Sit down."
The words were spoken quietly, but their effect on Pardlow was instantaneous. He froze, and everything in his face save his eyes went blank. Leaning forward, Jamie peered over Jenny's shoulder to see a large Highland dag in her hand, its 18-inch barrel trained steadily on the Duke's chest. What he could see of her face was white and set like marble. "You heard me," she said, her voice little more than a whisper. Very slowly. Pardlow, yes, it really was him, Jamie's eyes informed his dazed mind, took two steps backward and lowered himself into the chair. Jamie could smell the gunpowder in the priming pan and thought the Duke very likely could too.
"Lord Melton," Jenny said, moving slightly so as to have him silhouetted against the dim light that filtered through the shutters. "My good sister said that you're Lord Melton, or were. Is that so?"
"Yes," Pardlow said.
He wasn't moving, but Jamie saw that he had sat down with his legs flexed under him. He could be out of the chair in one lunge if he chose. Very quietly, Jamie edged to the side. He was close enough that Jenny should have sensed him behind her, but he could see why she didn't. Her shoulder blades were pressed together in concentration, sharp-edged under the cloth as a pair of hawk's wings.
"It was your men who came to my house," she said, her voice low. "Came more than once, to loot and destroy, to take the food from our mouths. Who took my husband away?"
For an instant the barrel trembled, but then steadied again.
"Away to the prison where he took the ill that killed him." "Move one inch, my lord, and I'll shoot you in the guts. You'll die quicker than he did, but I dare say you will not think it fast enough."
Pardlow didn't say a word, but moved his head a fraction of an inch to indicate that he'd understood her. His hands, which had been clutching the arms of the chair, relaxed. His eyes left the pistol and saw Jamie. His mouth fell open, his eyes sprang wide, and Jenny's finger whitened on the trigger. Jamie got a hand under the gun just as it went off in a puff of black smoke, the crack of the firing simultaneous with the explosion of a china figure on the mantelpiece. Pardlow sat frozen for an instant, then, very carefully, reached up and removed a large shard of porcelain from his hair.
"Mr. Fraser," he said, in a voice that was almost steady. "Your servant, sir." "Your most obedient, Your Grace," Jamie replied, suffering an insane urge to laugh,
and kept from it only by the sure knowledge that his sister would immediately reload and shoot him at point-blank range if he did.
"I see you're acquainted with my sister, Mrs. Murray." "Your dear lord, she is."
Pardlow's eyes had flicked back and forth between their faces, and he now drew a long, slow breath.
"Is your entire family given to irascibility?" "We are, Your Grace, and I thank you for the compliment," Jamie said,
and laid a hand on Jenny's back. He could feel her heart going like a trip hammer, and her breath was coming in shallow pants. Putting the pistol aside, he took her hand in both of his. It was cold as ice in spite of the temperature in the room, which was slightly hotter than Hades, with the window shuttered and boarded over.
"Would you be so amiable as to pour out a dram of whatever is in that decanter, Your Grace?"
Pardlow did, and approached warily, holding out the glass. It was brandy. Jamie could smell the hot fumes.
"Don't let him out," Jenny said, getting hold of herself. She glared at Pardlow and took the brandy, then glared at Jamie.
"And where, in the name of St. Mary Magdalene, have you been these 3 days past?" Before he could answer, heavy footsteps came hastily down the hallway, and the black housekeeper appeared in the doorway, breathing audibly, and holding a silver inlaid fowling piece in a manner suggesting that she knew what to do with it.
"The two of you can just sit yourselves down this minute," she said, moving the barrel of the gun back and forth between Pardlow and Jamie in a businesslike fashion. "If you think you're going to take that man out of here, you—"
"I told you."
"I beg your pardon, madam, but would ye honour me with your name?"
You... What? The housekeeper blinked, disconcerted.
I... Mrs. Mortimer Fig, if it's any of your business, and I doubt that.
So do I, Jamie assured her, not sitting down.
The Duke, he saw, had.
Mrs. Fig, as I said to you downstairs, I've come for my wife and nothing more. If you'll tell me where she is, I'll leave you to your business. Whatever that may be, he added, with a glance at Pardlow.
Your wife? Mrs. Fig repeated, and the barrel swiveled toward him.
Well now, I'm thinking that perhaps you ought just to sit down and wait until his lordship comes, and we see what he has to say about all this.
Dinna be daft, Jerusha, said Jenny rather impatiently. You ken Claire's my brother's wife. She told you that herself.
Claire, exclaimed Pardlow, standing up again. He had been drinking from the decanter, and still held it carelessly in one hand.
My brother's wife?
She's no such thing, Jamie said crossly. She's mine, and I'll thank someone to tell me where the devil she is.
She's gone to a place called King Sessing, Jenny said promptly, to pick herbs and the like.
We've been doctoring this Machnagala, she scowled at Pardlow. Had I kent who you were, Vicon Giel, I'd have put ground glass in your food.
I dare say, Pardlow murmured, and took another gulp from the decanter.
He turned his attention to Jamie.
I don't suppose that you know where my brother is at the moment.
Jamie stared at him, a sudden feeling of unease tickling the back of his neck.
Is he not here?
Pardlow made a wide gesture round the room, wordlessly inviting Jamie to look. Jamie ignored him and turned to the housekeeper.
When did you see him last, madam?
Just before he and you skedaddled out the attic window, she replied shortly, and prodded him in the ribs with the barrel of the fowling piece. What have you done with him, Feastersalop?
Jamie edged the barrel gingerly aside with one finger. The fowling piece was primed, but not yet cocked.
I left him in the woods outside the city 2 days ago, he said, a sudden feeling of disquiet tightening the muscles at the base of his spine.
He backed against the wall, discreetly pressing his arse into it to ease his back.
I expected to find him here, with my wife. Might I inquire how you come to be here, Your Grace?
Claire kidnapped him, Jenny said, before Pardlow could speak. The Duke's eyes bulged slightly, though whether at the remark or at the fact that Jenny was reloading her pistol, Jamie couldn't tell.
Oh, aye. What did she want him for? Did she say?
His sister gave him a look. She was afraid he'd turn the city upside down looking for his brother, and you'd be taken up in the kerfuffle.
Aye, well, I think I'm safe enough now, he assured Jenny. Ought you to turn him loose, do you think?
No, she said promptly, pounding home her ball and patch.
She reached into her apron and came out with a tiny powder horn.
We cannot do that. He might die.
Oh.
He considered this for a moment, watching the Duke, whose face had assumed a slight purple tinge.
Why's that?
He cannot breathe properly, and she was afraid if she let him loose before he was quite over it, he'd die in the street, and her conscience wouldn't let her do that.
I see.
The urge to laugh was back, but he controlled it manfully.
So, you were about to shoot him in the house in order to keep him from dying in the street?
Her dark blue eyes narrowed, though she kept her gaze fixed on the powder she was pouring into the priming pan.
I wouldn't really have shot him in the guts, she said, though from the press of her lips it was apparent that she'd have liked nothing more. I just have winged him in the leg. Or maybe shot off a couple of twos.
Pardlow made a sound that might have been outrage, but knowing the man as he did, Jamie recognised it as smothered laughter.
He hoped his sister wouldn't.
He opened his mouth to ask just how long Pardlow had been held captive, but before he could speak, there was a knock at the door below. He glanced at Mrs. Fig, but the housekeeper was still regarding him with narrowed eyes and made no move either to lower the fowling piece or to go downstairs and answer the door.
"Come in," Jamie shouted, sticking his head out into the hall, then jerking it back into the room before Mrs. Fig should take it into her head that he was attempting to escape and discharge a load of buckshot into his backside. The door opened, closed, and there was a pause as the caller apparently looked around the devastated entry. Then light, quick steps came up the stairs.
"Lord John," breathed Mrs. Fig, her stern face lightening.
"In here," called the Duke, as the steps reached the landing. An instant later, the slight, bespectacled form of Denzel Hunter appeared in the doorway.
"Merde," said Mrs. Fig, bringing her shotgun to bear on the newcomer. "I mean, Shepherd of Judea. Who in the name of the Holy Trinity are you?"
Hunter was nearly as pale as Jenny, Jamie thought. Nonetheless, he didn't blink or pause, but walked up to Pardlow and said, "I am Denzel Hunter, friend Grey. I'm a physician, come at the request of Claire Fraser to attend thee." The Duke dropped the decanter, which fell over and disgorged the few drops it still contained, onto the braided hearthrug.
"You,"
he said, drawing himself abruptly to his full height. He was, in fact, no taller than Hunter, but it was obvious that he had the habit of command.
"You are the skulking fellow who has had the temerity to seduce my daughter? And you dare come here and offer to physic me? Get out of my sight before I—"
At this point, it dawned on Pardlow that he was in his nightshirt and unarmed. Nothing daunted, he seized the decanter from the floor and swung it at Denzel's head. Denzel ducked, and Jamie got hold of Pardlow's wrist before he could try again. Denzel straightened up, fire glinting behind his spectacles.
"I take issue both with thy description of my behaviour and thy slur upon thy daughter's reputation," he said sharply. "I can only conceive that the order of thy mind is deranged by illness or drugs. For surely the man who sired and reared such a person as Dorothea could not speak so meanly of her, or have so little faith in her strength of character and her virtue, as to think that anyone might seduce her."
"I'm sure his grease didn't mean physical seduction," Jamie said hastily, twisting Pardlow's wrist to make him let go of the decanter.
"Is it the act of a gentleman, sir, to induce a young woman to run away with him? Ow! Let go, damn you," he said, dropping the decanter as Jamie jerked his arm up behind his back.
It fell to the hearth and burst in a shower of glass, but the Duke disregarded this entirely.
"A gentleman would have sought the approval of the young lady's father, sir, before ever venturing to speak to her."
"I did," Denzel said more mildly.
"Or rather, I did write to thee at once, apologizing for having been unable to speak with thee in person beforehand, and explaining that Dorothea and I wished to become betrothed and sought thy blessing upon our desire. I doubt thee received my letter before embarking for America, though." "Oh, thee did thee? Your desire?" Pardlow snorted, tossing a hank of loosened hair out of his face. "Will you let go of me, you bloody Scotchman? What do you think I'm going to do, strangle him with his own neckcloth?"
"You might," Jamie said, easing his grip but keeping hold of Pardlow's wrist.
"Jenny, would you put that pistol somewhere out of his grease's reach?"
Jenny promptly handed the freshly loaded pistol to Denzel, who took it by reflex, then regarded the thing in his hand in astonishment.
"You need it more than I do," she said, and looked grimly at the Duke. "If you shoot him, we'll all swear it was self-defense." "We will not," said Mrs. Fig indignantly. "If you think I'm going to tell his lordship I let his brother be murdered in cold blood—"
"Friend Jamie," Denny interrupted, holding out the pistol, "I should feel much happier with thee to release Dorothea's father and take charge of this. I think that might increase the civility of our conversation."
"It might,"
Jamie said dubiously, but let go of Pardlow and took the pistol. Denny approached the Duke, edging glass shards out of the way, and looked carefully into his face.
"I will be pleased to speak and counsel with thee, friend, and offer any reassurances that lie within my power regarding thy daughter. But thy breathing alarms me, and I would examine thee first."
The Duke was, in fact, making a faint wheezing noise, and Jamie noted that the purple tinge to his face had become more pronounced. At Denzel's remark, this was augmented by a wash of dull red.
"You don't touch me, you quacksalver!"
Denzel glanced round and seized upon Jenny as the most likely source of information.
"What did friend Claire say regarding him, in terms of ailment and treatment?"
"Asthma, and joint for brewed in coffee," Jenny replied promptly, turning to add to Pardlow,
"You can. I didn't have to tell him that. I might have let you strangle, but I suppose that's no a Christian way to carry on."
"Are Quakers Christians, by the by?" she asked Denny curiously.
"Yes," he replied,
advancing cautiously on Pardlow, whom Jamie had forced to sit down by pressing on his shoulder.
"We believe the light of Christ is present in all men, though in some cases perceiving it is somewhat difficult," he added under his breath, but loud enough for Jamie and the Duke to hear.
Pardlow appeared to be trying to whistle, blowing with pursed lips, meanwhile glaring at Denzel. He gasped in air and managed a few more words.
"I will not be doctored by you, sir."
Another pause for blowing and gasping. Jamie noted Mrs. Fig stir uneasily and take a step toward the door.
"I will not leave my daughter in your clutches. If you kill me, nor risk you saving my life and putting me in your debt."
The effort involved in getting that one out turned him a ghastly grey, and Jamie was seriously alarmed.
"Has he medicine, Jenny?" he asked urgently.
His sister compressed her lips but nodded, and with a final glare at the Duke, scurried out of the room. With the ginger air of one embracing a crocodile, Denzel Hunter crouched, took hold of the Duke's wrist, and peered closely into his eyes, these organs repaying his inspection by narrowing in the most threatening fashion manageable by a man dying of suffocation. Not for the first time, Jamie suffered a reluctant admiration for Pardlow's strength of character, though he was likewise obliged to admit that Hunter's nearly matched it. His concentration on the tableau before him was broken by the sound of an excited fist hammering on the front door below. The door opened, and he heard his nephew Ian exclaim,
"Mom!"
in a hoarse voice, concurrent with his sister's astonished,
"Ian!"
Jamie stepped out of the room, and reaching the shattered banister in a few steps, saw his sister engulfed and all but obliterated by her tall son's embrace. Ian's eyes were closed, and his cheeks wet, arms wrapped tight round his small mother, and Jamie felt a sudden lump in his own throat. What would he not give to embrace his daughter that way once more? A slight motion drew his eye, and he saw Rachel Hunter standing shyly back, smiling at mother and son, her own eyes filled with tears. She dabbed at her nose with a handkerchief, then, happening to glance up, saw Jamie above, and blinked.
"Miss Rachel," he said, smiling down at her.
He pointed at a jug standing on the occasional table by the door, which he assumed was Pardlow's medicine.
"Might you bring that wee jug up here, quickly?"
He could hear Pardlow's heavy breathing from the room behind him. It didn't seem to be getting worse, but was still worrying. The gasping was momentarily drowned out by the footsteps of Mrs. Fig appearing behind him with her fowling piece. She peered over the banister at the touching scene below, then at Rachel Hunter, trotting up the stairs, jug in hand.
"And who is this?"
she demanded of Jamie, not quite brandishing her weapon under his nose.
"Dr. Hunter's sister," he told her, interposing his body between Rachel, who looked taken aback, and the agitated housekeeper. "Your brother wants the stuff in the jug, Miss Rachel."
Mrs. Fig made a low rumbling noise, but stepped back and allowed Rachel to pass. With a bleak look down at Jenny and Ian, who had now separated enough to speak and were waving their hands and interrupting each other in excited Gaelic, she vanished back into the bedroom on Rachel's heels. Jamie hesitated, wanting to rush out the front door and head for King Sessing, but a sense of morbid responsibility obliged him to follow her. Denny had pulled up the stool from the dressing table and was still holding Pardlow's wrist, addressing him in calm tones.
"Thee is in no immediate danger, as thee likely knows. Thy pulse is strong and regular, and while thy breathing is clearly compromised, I think... Ah, is this the tincture the Scotswoman mentioned? I thank thee, Rachel, will thee pour."
But Rachel, long accustomed to medical situations, was already decanting into the brandy glass some blackish-brown stuff that looked like the contents of a spittoon.
"Shall I?"
Denzel's attempt to hold the glass for the Duke was preempted by Pardlow's seizing the glass for himself and taking a gulp that all but choked him on the spot. Hunter calmly observed the coughing and spluttering, then handed him a handkerchief.
"I have heard it theorized that such cataclysms of breath as these experiencing may be precipitated by violent exercise, a rapid change of temperature, exposure to smoke or dust, or, in some cases, by a surge of violent emotion. In the present instance, I believe I may possibly have caused thy crisis by my appearance, and if so, I ask thy pardon."
Denny took the handkerchief and handed Pardlow back the glass, wise enough not to tell him to sip the stuff.
"Perhaps I may make some recompense for this injury, though," he said. "I gather thy brother is not at home, since I can't suppose that he would remain absent from this gathering unless he were dead in the cellar, and I should hope that's not the case. Has thee seen him recently?"
"I have not."
Pardlow's breathing was, in fact, growing smoother, and his face a more normal colour, though the expression on it was still feral.
"Have you?"
Hunter took off his spectacles and smiled, and Jamie was struck by the kindness of his eyes. He glanced at Rachel. Her eyes were hazel rather than her brother's soft olive brown, and, while good-natured, were much warier. Jamie thought wariness a good thing in a woman.
"I have, friend. Thy daughter and I discovered him in a militia camp some distance from the city. He had been taken prisoner and..."
Pardlow's exclamation collided with Jamie's, and Hunter patted the air with his hand, begging attention.
"We were able to assist his escape, and since he'd been injured during his capture, I treated him. His injuries were not intrinsically serious." "When?" Jamie asked. "When did you see him?"
His heart had given a small, disquietingly happy lurch at the news that John Grey was not dead.
"Last night," Denny told him. "We heard of his escape this morning and heard nothing of his recapture as we made our way back to Philadelphia, though I asked each group of regulars or militia we encountered. He will have needed to go with care, both woods and roads being alive with men. But I imagine he'll be with you soon."
Pardlow drew a long, deep breath.
"Oh, God," he said,
and closed his eyes. Chapter 24. Welcome coolness in the heat. Comfort in the midst of woe. There was plenty of cool greenery available. The gardens covered the best part of 100 acres, with trees, bushes, shrubs, vines, and flowers of all descriptions, and the odd exotic fungus thrown in here and there for variety. John Bartram had spent the greater part of a long life combing the Americas for botanical specimens, most of which he had hauled home and induced to grow. I regretted not having met the old gentleman. He had died a year before, leaving his famous garden in the capable hands of his children. I found young Mr. Bartram, he was about 40, but so-called to distinguish him from his elder brother, in the centre of the gardens, sitting under the shade of an immense creeper that covered half the porch of his house, a sketchbook open on the table before him, making careful drawings of a handful of pale, leggy roots that lay on a napkin. "Ginseng?" I asked, bending to peer at them.
"Yes,"
he said, not taking his eyes off the delicate line of his pen.
"Good morning, Lady John. You're familiar with the root, I see."
"It's fairly common in the mountains of North Carolina, where I used to live." The casual sentence caught in my throat with sudden unexpectedness. Out of nowhere, I smelled the woods on Fraser's Ridge, pungent with balsam fir and poplar sap, heavy with the musty scent of wood ears and the tang of wild muscats.
"Yes, indeed."
Reaching the end of his line, he set down his pen, removed his spectacles, and looked up at me with the bright face of a man who lives for plants and fully expects the world to share his obsession.
"These are Chinese ginseng. I want to see whether I might be able to persuade it to grow here."
He waved a hand towards the encompassing acres of lush garden. "The Carolina variety languishes, and the Canadian ginseng stubbornly refuses even to try."
"How very perverse of it, though I expect it's too hot," I observed, taking the stool he gestured me to, and setting down my basket on the floor. My shift was sticking to me, and I could feel a large splotch of spreading wetness between my shoulder blades, where my hair dripped sweat down my back.
"They like cold weather."
The vivid memory of the woods had blossomed into a visceral longing for the ridge, so immediate, that I felt the ghost of my vanished house rise around me, a cold mountain wind thrumming past its walls, and thought that if I reached down, I could feel Adso's soft grey fur under my fingers.
I swallowed hard.
"It is hot," he said, though he himself looked as dry as one of the roots on the table, dappled with shade from his vine. "May I offer you some refreshment, Lady John? I have some iced negus in the house."
"I'd love it," I said, meaning it, "but iced?"
"Oh, we have quite a large ice house by the river, Sissy and I," he said proudly. "Let me just tell her."
I had had sufficient forethought to bring a fan with me, and now pulled this out of my basket. The sense of longing had turned suddenly into a new and wonderful realization. We could go home. Jamie had been released from service with the Continental Army in order to see his cousin's body back to Scotland. He'd meant, when we returned, to go back to North Carolina, reclaim his printing press, and take up arms on behalf of the revolution via the pen rather than the sword. That plan had vanished, along with the rest of my life, when he'd been reported drowned. But now... A thrill of excitement ran through me and must have shown on my face, for Mr. and Miss Bartram both blinked at me as they came out onto the porch. They were twins, and while their faces bore only a faint similarity of feature, they often shared the same expression, and were doing so presently, both looking slightly bewildered but pleased. I could barely keep myself from sharing my wonderful thought with them, but that wouldn't do, and I managed to sip the negus, port mixed with hot water, sugar and spices, then chilled to a cold, truly cold, water-beaded delight, and engage in civil admiration of the ongoing improvements to Bartram's garden, these being already famous for their beauty and variety. Old Mr. Bartram had been planning and planting and extending them for 50 years, and his children had evidently inherited the family mania, as well as the gardens.
"And we've improved the river path, and we've just put up a much bigger potting shed," Sissy Bartram was saying eagerly. "So many customers wanting potted vines and flowers for their drawing rooms and conservatories. Though I don't know..."
Her eagerness faded a little, and she made a moue of doubt.
"With all this kerfuffle, war is so bad for business."
Mr. Bartram coughed a little.
It does depend on the sort of business, he said mildly, and I'm afraid we shall have a much increased demand for the medicinals.
But if the army is leaving, Miss Bartram began hopefully.
But her brother shook his head, his face glowing sober.
Does he not feel it in the air, Sissy? He said softly. Something is coming.
He lifted his face as though scenting something on the heavy air, and she reached to put a hand on his arm, silent, listening with him for the sound of distant violence.
I hadn't realized that you were friends, Mr. Bartram, I said, to break the ominous quiet. Both of them blinked and smiled at me.
Oh, said Miss Bartram. Father was read out of meeting some years ago, but sometimes the habits of childhood come back when you least expect them.
She lifted one plump shoulder, smiling, but with something regretful behind it.
I see you have a lisp, Lady John.
That recalled me abruptly to my business, and the next hour was spent in busy exploration, discussion of the merits and drawbacks of various medicinals, the selection of dried herbs from the vast drying sheds, and cutting of fresh ones from the beds. With my sudden realization that we might return to the ridge quite soon, and Mr. Bartram's very acute observation about the impending demand for medicinals, I bought much more than I had originally intended, replenishing not only my usual stocks, including a pound of dried Chinese joint fur just in case. What was I going to do with the bloody man? But also a good quantity of Jesuit bark, elecampane, and even lobelia, plus asafoetida and ginseng, I promised Denny. In the end, there was too much for my basket, and Miss Bartram said she would put it up into a package and have one of the assistant gardeners who lived in Philadelphia bring it into the city when he went home in the evening.
"Would you like to see the river path before you go?"
she asked me with a quick glance skyward.
"It's not finished yet, of course, but we have some amazing things put in, and it's wonderfully cool at this time of day."
"Oh, thank you. I really—"
"Wait. You wouldn't have fresh arrowhead down there, would you?"
I hadn't thought to put that on my list, but if it was available...
"Oh, yes!" she cried, beaming. "Masses of it!"
We were standing in the largest of the drying sheds, and the late afternoon light falling through the boards striped the walls with bars of swimming gold, illuminating the constant rain of tiny pollen grains from the drying flowers. There was a scatter of tools on the table, and she plucked a wooden trowel and a stubby knife from the litter without hesitation.
"Would you like to dig your own?"
I laughed with pleasure. The opportunity to grub around in the wet mud wasn't an offer that most women would have made, especially to another woman dressed in pale blue muslin. But Miss Bartram spoke my language. I hadn't had my hands in the earth in months, and the mere suggestion made my fingers tingle.
The river path was lovely, edged with willow and silver birch that cast a flickering shade over banks of nasturtium and azalea and the floating masses of dark green cress. I felt my blood pressure drop as we strolled, chatting of this and that.
"Do you mind if I ask you something about the friends?" I asked. "I have a colleague who was read out of meeting, he and his sister, because he volunteered as a surgeon with the Continental Army. Since you mentioned your father, I wondered, how important a thing is that? Belonging to a meeting, I mean."
"Oh!"
She laughed, rather to my surprise. "I imagine it depends upon the individual. Everything does, really, as a friend. My father, for instance... He was read out of meeting for refusing to acknowledge the divinity of Jesus Christ. But he went right on going to meeting. It made no particular difference to him."
"Oh, that was rather reassuring. What is a Quaker marriage like?
Would one have to belong to a meeting in order to get married?" She thought that interesting and made low humming noises for a bit.
"Well... a marriage between friends is... between the friends for marrying. No clergyman, I mean, and no specific prayer or service. The two friends marry each other,
rather than it being considered a sacrament administered by a priest or the like. But it does need to be done before witnesses. Other friends, you know, she added, a small crease forming between her brows. And I think that there might be considerable objection if the friends involved, or one of them, had been formally expelled.
How interesting. Thank you. I wondered how this might affect Denzel and Dorothea. Even more, how it might affect Rachel and Ian.
Can a friend marry a, non-friend?
Oh, yes, of course. Though I think they would be put out of meeting as a result, she added dubiously. But there might be special consideration for dire circumstances. The meeting would appoint a committee of clearness to look into the situation, I suppose.
I hadn't got so far as worrying about dire circumstances, but thanked her, and the conversation went back to plants. She'd been right about the arrowhead. There were masses of it. She smiled happily at my amazement, but then left me to my digging, assuring me that I might take some of the lotus and some sweet flag rhizomes as well, if I liked.
And fresh cress, of course, she added over her shoulder, waving a blithe hand at the water. All you like.
She'd thoughtfully brought along a burlap sack for me to kneel on. I spread it carefully, not to crush anything, and curtled up my skirts out of the way as best I could. There was a faint breeze. There always is over moving water. And I sighed in relief, both at the coolness and the sudden sense of solitude. The company of plants is always soothing, and after the incessant, well, you couldn't call it sociability exactly, but at least the incessant presence of people requiring to be conversed with, directed, hectored, scolded, conferred with, persuaded, lied to, that I had experienced over the last few days, I found the rooted silence, rushing stream and rustling leaves balm to the spirit.
Frankly, I thought, my spirit could use a bit of balm. Between, or rather among, Jamie, John, Hal, William, Ian, Denny Hunter, and Benedict Arnold, to say nothing of Captain Richardson, General Clinton, Colenso, and the whole bloody Continental Army, the male of the species had been rather wearing on my nerves of late.
I dug slowly and peaceably, lifting the dripping roots into my basket and packing each layer between mats of watercress. Sweat was running down my face and between my breasts, but I didn't notice it. I was melting quietly into the landscape, breath and muscle turning to wind and earth and water.
Cicadas buzzed heavily in the trees nearby, and gnats and mosquitoes were beginning to collect in uneasy clouds overhead. These were luckily only a nuisance when they flew up my nose or hovered too close to my face. Apparently, my 20th century blood wasn't attractive to 18th century insects, and I was almost never bitten. A great blessing to a gardener. Lulled into mindlessness, I had quite lost track of time and place. And when a pair of large battered shoes appeared in my field of view, I merely blinked at them for a moment, as I might at the sudden appearance of a frog. Then I looked up.
Oh, I said, a little blankly. Then,
there you are, I said, dropping my knife and scrambling to my feet in a surge of joyous relief. Where the bloody hell have you been?
A smile flickered briefly across Jamie's face, and he took my hands, wet and muddy as they were. His were large and warm and solid.
"In a wagon full of cabbages, most recently," he said,
and the smile took hold as he looked me over.
"You look well, Sassnach. Very bonny."
"You don't," I said frankly.
He was grubby, very thin, and he plainly hadn't been sleeping well. He had shaved, but his face was gaunt and shadowed. "What's happened?" He opened his mouth to reply, but then seemed to think better of it. He let go my hands, cleared his throat with a low Scottish noise, and fixed his eyes on mine. The smile had gone.
"You went to bed with John Gray, aye?"
I blinked, startled, then frowned at him.
Well, no, I wouldn't say that.
His eyebrows rose.
He told me you did.
Is that what he said? I asked, surprised.
Mm-hmm.
Now it was his turn to frown.
He told me he'd had carnal knowledge of you. Why would he lie about such a thing as that?
Oh, I said. No, that's right. Carnal knowledge is a very reasonable description of what happened.
But?
Going to bed, though. For one thing, we didn't. It started on a dressing table and ended, so far as I recall, on the floor. Jamie's eyes widened noticeably, and I hastened to correct the impression he was obviously forming. For another, that phraseology implies that we decided to make love to each other and toddled off hand in hand to do so. And that wasn't what happened at all. Perhaps we should sit down? I gestured toward a rustic bench, standing knee-deep in creamy drifts of ranunculus. I hadn't had a single thought of that night since learning Jamie was alive, but it was beginning to dawn on me that it might quite possibly seem important to Jamie, and that explaining what had happened might be somewhat tricky. He nodded rather stiffly and turned toward the bench. I followed, noting with some concern the set of his shoulders. "Have you hurt your back?" I asked, frowning as I saw the care with which he sat down.
"What did happen?"
he asked, ignoring the question, politely but with a distinct edge. I took a deep breath, then blew out my cheeks in a helpless gesture. He growled. I glanced at him, startled, having never heard such a noise from him before, at least not aimed at me. Apparently it was somewhat more than important. I said cautiously, sitting down beside him. What did John say, exactly? After telling you about the carnal knowledge, I mean.
He desired me to kill him. And if you tell me you want me to kill you rather than tell me what happened, I warn you, I will not be responsible for what happens next.
I looked at him narrowly. He seemed self-possessed, but there was an undeniable tension in his posture. Well, I remember how it began, at least.
Start there, he suggested,
the edge more pronounced. I was sitting in my room, drinking plum brandy and trying to justify killing myself, if you must know, I said, with an edge of my own. I stared at him, daring him to say something, but he merely cocked his head at me in a go-on-then gesture. I ran out of brandy and was trying to decide whether I might walk downstairs to look for more without breaking my neck, or whether I'd had enough not to feel guilty about drinking the whole bottle of laudanum instead. And then John came in. I swallowed, my mouth suddenly dry and sticky as it had been that night.
He did see there was drink taken,
Jamie observed. Lots?
He seemed nearly as drunk as I was, save that he was still on his feet.
I could see John's face in memory, white as bone save for his eyes, which were so red and swollen that they might have been sandpapered. And the expression in those eyes. He looked the way a man looks just before he throws himself off a cliff. I said quietly, eyes on my folded hands. I took another breath. He had a fresh decanter in his hand. He put it down on the dressing table beside me, glared at me, and said, "I will not mourn him alone tonight." A deep quiver ran through me at the memory of those words.
"And?"
"And he didn't," I said, a little sharply. I told him to sit down, and he did. And he poured out more brandy, and we drank it. And I have not one single notion what we said, but we were talking about you. And then he stood up, and I stood up, and I couldn't bear to be alone, and I couldn't bear for him to be alone. And I more or less flung myself at him, because I very much needed someone to touch me just then.
And he obliged ye, I take it.
The tone of this was distinctly cynical, and I felt a flush rise in my cheeks,
not of embarrassment, but of anger.
Did he bugger you?
I looked at him for a good long minute. He meant it.
You absolute bastard,
I said, as much in astonishment as anger. Then a thought occurred to me.
You said he desired you to kill him, I said slowly.
You didn't, did you? He held my eyes, his own steady as a rifle barrel.
Would you mind if I did? He asked softly.
Yes, I bloody well would, I said, with what spirit I could summon up amongst the growing confusion of my feelings. But you didn't. I know you didn't.
No,
he said, even more softly.
You don't know that.
Despite my conviction that he was bluffing, a small chill prickled the hairs on my forearms.
I should have been within my rights, he said.
You would not, I said, chill fading into crossness. You didn't have any rights. You were bloody dead. Despite the crossness, my voice broke a bit over the word dead, and his face changed at once. What? I said, turning my own face away. Did you think it didn't matter?
No,
he said, and took my mud-stained hand in his.
But I didn't ken it mattered quite that much.
His own voice was husky now, and when I turned back to him, I saw that tears stood in his eyes. With an incoherent noise, I flung myself into his arms and clung to him, making foolish hiccuping sobs. He held me tight, his breath warm on the top of my head, and when I stopped at last, he put me away a little and cupped my face in his hands.
I have loved you since I saw you, Sassenach, he said, very quietly, holding my eyes with his own, bloodshot and lined with tiredness, but very blue. I will love you forever. It doesn't matter if you sleep with the whole English army.
Well, no, he corrected himself.
It would matter, but it wouldn't stop me loving you.
I didn't think it would. I sniffed, and he pulled a handkerchief from his sleeve and handed it to me. It was worn white cambric and had the initial P embroidered awkwardly in one corner in blue thread. I couldn't imagine where he got such a thing, but didn't bother asking, under the circumstances. The bench wasn't very large, and his knee was within an inch or two of mine. He didn't touch me again, though, and my heart rate was beginning to speed up noticeably. He meant it, about loving me, but that didn't mean the next while was going to be pleasant.
It was my impression that he told me because he was sure that you would tell me, he said carefully.
So I would have, I said promptly, wiping my nose. Though I might possibly have waited till you'd got home and had a bath and been fed supper. If there's one thing I know about men, it's that you don't break things like this to them on an empty stomach. When did you last eat?
This morning. Sausages. Dinner be changing the subject.
His voice was level, but there was a good deal of feeling bubbling under it. He might as well have been a pan of simmering milk. One extra degree of heat, and there'd be an eruption and scorched milk all over the stove.
I understand, but I need to know what happened.
You understand? I echoed, sounding surprised even to my own ears. I hoped he did understand, but his manner was more than a little at odds with his words. My hands were no longer cold. They were starting to sweat, and I gripped the skirt over my knees, heedless of mud stains.
Well, I dinna like it, he said,
not quite between clenched teeth.
But I understand it.
You do?
I do, he said, eyeing me. You both thought I was dead. And I ken what you're like when you're drunk, Sassenach.
I slapped him, so fast and so hard that he hadn't time to duck, and lurched back from the impact. You, I said,
unable to articulate anything bad enough to suit the violence of my feelings.
How bloody dare you!
He touched his cheek gingerly. His mouth was twitching.
I didn't quite mean that the way it sounded, Sassenach, he said. Besides, am I no the aggrieved party here?
No, you bloody aren't, I snapped. You go off and get drowned, and leave me all alone in the midst of spies and soldiers and with children. You and Fergus both, you bastards. Leave me and Masali to...
I was so choked with emotion that I couldn't go on. I was damned if I'd cry, though. Damned if I'd cry any more in front of him. He reached out carefully and took my hand again. I let him, and let him draw me closer, close enough to see the faint dusting of his beard stubble, to smell the road dust and dried sweat in his clothes, to feel the radiant heat from his body. I sat quivering, making small huffing sounds in lieu of speech. He ignored this, spreading my fingers out between his own, gently stroking the palm of my hand with a large, calloused thumb.
"I didn't mean to imply that I think you're drunkard, Sassenach," he said, making an obvious effort to be conciliatory. "It's only that you think we are body clear. You always have."
With a tremendous effort of my own, I found words. "So I'm what are you calling me now? A loose woman? A trollop? A strumpet? And you think that's better than calling me a drunkard?" He gave a small snort of what might have been amusement. I yanked at my hand, but he wouldn't let go.
"I said what I meant, Sassenach," he said, tightening his grip on my hand and augmenting it with another hand on my forearm, preventing me from rising. "You think we're your body. That's what makes you a surgeon, no?"
Overcoming my dudgeon momentarily, I was obliged to admit that there was something in this observation.
"Possibly," I said stiffly, looking away from him.
"But I don't think that's what you meant."
"Not entirely, no."
There was a very slight edge to his voice again, but I wouldn't meet his eyes.
"Listen to me."
I sat stubbornly silent for a moment, but he simply held on, and I knew that he was more stubborn by nature than I could be if I worked at it for 100 years. I was going to hear what he had to say, and I was going to tell him what he wanted to hear, whether I liked it or not.
"I'm listening," I said.
He drew breath and relaxed a little, but didn't lessen his grip.
"I've taken you to bed 1,000 times at least, Sassenach," he said mildly. "Do you think I wasn't paying attention?"
2,000 or 3,000 at least," I said, in the interests of strict accuracy, staring at the digging knife I dropped on the ground. "And no."
"Well then, I ken what you're like in bed. And I see all too well," he added, his mouth compressing momentarily, "how this likely was."
"No, you bloody don't," I said warmly. He made another Scottish noise, this one indicating hesitation.
"I do," he said, but carefully. "When I lost you after Culloden, I kent you weren't dead. But that made it all the worse, if you ask me."
"Eh?" I had made a noise of my own, but gestured briefly at him to go on.
"I told you about Mary McNab, how she came to me in the cave."
"Several years after the fact," I said, rather coldly. "But yes, you did get round to it eventually." I gave him a look. I certainly didn't blame you for that. And I didn't ask you for the gory details either.
"No, you didn't," he admitted.